And it is today's Topical Currents, Wednesday edition, Joseph Cooper, along with Bonnie Berman. This hour we visit with two California-based scholars who've co-authored the book Clash, Eight Cultural Conflicts That Make Us Who We Are. We have Stanford University Behavioral Science Professor, Dr. Hazel Rose Marcus. Welcome to you, Professor.
Thanks. Thanks for having us.
And also with us is co-author Dr. Elena Connor, or is it Alana?
That's a great question.
depends on your culture.
It depends on your culture. My family calls me, it's written A-L-A-N-A. My family pronounces it Elena, but out in the world, that name often turns into Alana. So I say
okay.
Yeah, whichever way you want to go. I'm flexible.
Okay, Dr. Elena Connor. She's an experimental psychologist, consultant, speaker, and researcher. And they both join us from Stanford University. So welcome to you both.
Thanks for having us.
So I don't know who wants to take this. I just thought a good place to begin would be by defining culture in the context you used it for your research and your studies. What is culture? A culture.
Well, It's a great question, because if you look in the literature, there's 200 different definitions of culture, and we take a very simple definition that it's the four I's, the ideas, institutions, interactions, and individual I's or psychologies that all form this cycle that directs how we think and feel and act.
And what we stress is that each of us interacts with many cultures in a lifetime and in a single day, and we're shaped by them, and we shape them. So the eyes, the individuals, are part of the culture cycle.
So expand on a big part of your book, which is the independent versus the interdependent.
So in our book, we argue that, you know, the world is getting smaller and flatter and hotter, we see all these culture clashes, people with different cultural backgrounds fighting more than ever before. And we find that at the heart of many of these conflicts is the clash of independence and interdependence. And so all of us have two sides to ourselves. And our independent side wants to be separate, unique, and in control, while our interdependent side wants to be connected and similar and cooperative. And as Hazel said, depending on your particular mix of cultures, you tend to use one side more than the other, and tensions flare when people using their more independent side interact with people using their more interdependent side.
And
you
so what we've
you
done
say there's more cultural squabbles today than, I mean, I certainly know many of them historically. Look at Europe.
Yeah, sure. People like to fight. It's sort of we're both very good at taking care of each other, and we're also very good at fighting with each other.
And if you look at the recent data from the census, you'll see that we are more diverse than we've ever been. There's been a revolution in our diversity since the 1970s. So many of us grew up in a much less diverse world than we're living in now. And so people with all these different cultural backgrounds are bumping into each other. And that's what we take on in the book.
We're in South Florida, so
you
get it.
I'm assuming that this interdependent, independent way of breaking this down is just a jumping place for understanding cultural jumping off place for understanding cultural conflicts. Just a place to start. Is that right?
Yeah, sure. People fight for all sorts of reasons. There's a lot of fights over resources. There's a lot of fights that don't have to do with independence and interdependence colliding. However, in our book, we reveal, and we're not just saying this, we review hundreds of studies from across the social sciences, law, business, medicine, policy, showing that this collision of independence and interdependence explains a surprising amount of conflict in the world.
Tell us about the culture cycle and why it's important to change them.
The culture cycle is what influences our everyday actions, but as we explain, individuals are part of them. So we aren't determined by our cultures. We have a lot of agency, and so we can change the interactions that are part of our culture cycles. We can change the institutions, the practices, the policies, the laws, not individually, but working together with others. So cultures are not fixed or stable or monolithic. They are constantly evolving. They're changing. And as part of those culture cycles, we really have a big part in the cultures that are shaping us. So that's really one of our messages, how much we can do as individuals.
So, well, let's look at some of your areas of cultural conflict, beginning with one I found really interesting, the San Francisco versus Boston. You say that the West Coast of the U.S. is more independent than the East Coast, and I would think it's just the opposite when I think about a city like New York. So could you explain that?
Yeah, sure. And we're drawing on research from our colleague Vicky Plout, and she did a study comparing Boston versus San Francisco. But we think that a lot of what we find about Boston probably generalizes to San Francisco. And so many people think of these... So many people think of both Boston and San Francisco as latte-drinking, sushi-eating, liberal enclaves overrun with very independent people. But Vicky has lived in both places, and she knew that Boston and San Francisco are quite different. And so she did all these very cool studies, one of which was analyzing hundreds of newspaper headlines and websites originating from either Boston or San Francisco. And she and her team found that where the Boston organizations emphasize tradition, status, and community, which are all very interdependent themes, the San Francisco organizations emphasized innovation and egalitarianism and unlimited possibility, which are all very independent themes. And Vicky finds that Bostonians' sense of self-worth is more closely tied to the circumstances of people's families and communities, while San Franciscans' sense of self-worth is most closely tied to their work, to their individual achievements. And so even though compared to the heartland, to the Midwest or the South, both of the coasts are much more independent, we see this gradation between the West Coast and the East Coast.
Hmm. So Midwest, say Peoria, Kansas City, are more interdependent.
Correct.
Yeah, I mean, and I grew up in Tennessee, hence the pronunciation Alina, where people tend to use their very interdependent sides. And then I moved up to Connecticut to go to Yale as an undergraduate. And I personally really felt that collision where I was raised to, you may not notice this from this interview, but to sit silently and, you know, and appear stupid as opposed to opening your mouth and removing all doubt. This is something my grandmother told me. And then I went to this world where people were constantly sharing their opinions and their ideas, and it was very competitive. And it took me a long time to learn how to interact in this very independent way, really asserting myself and developing my unique attributes and, in fact, competing with other people's.
But when you talked about the South, you say that it's more interdependent than the coasts. But you said it more polite and helpful, but also more violent, or the most violent, I think you said. And that seems to be a contradiction. Could you explain that clash?
Sure. Yeah, the South is known as a culture of honor, and it's this really interesting combination where a Southerner's sense of self, many Southerners' senses of selves, rise and fall with the opinions of people around them. And so your reputation is incredibly important, and you also know that everyone else's reputation is very important. So we're very polite, and study after study confirms this. And we're so concerned with reputation, if someone insults us, we feel the need to set the record straight. And Southerners will often do that aggressively. And for that reason, the South is both the most polite, also the most helpful region, most interdependent region, but also the most violent region in the U.S.
Hmm. So both ways of being derive from this sense of themselves as interdependent. They're relatively more interdependent than people in the on the coasts.
Well, speaking of that, aren't coastal folks more liberal politically and more community-minded than in the heartland, where they're more isolated?
It's really a complicated thing to talk about liberalism and conservatism, but let me take a crack at it. We wanted to write a chapter on political liberalism and conservatism, but really we found that it came down to religious conservatism versus religious liberalism. And we find that conservative Protestants in particular These are evangelicals and fundamentalists think about God very differently than conservative, than liberal Protestants, mainline Protestants, which are your Methodists, your Baptist, your Presbyterians, your Anglicans. So like conservative fathers who both hug and spank their children more than liberal fathers, the conservative God is both more present and more punitive. It's a very interdependent God. But on the other hand, liberal Protestants think of God as more independent, separate, abstract, and even distant. And these two different ways of thinking about God reflect two different ways Protestants think about themselves, with conservative Protestants using their interdependent relational and cooperative sides more and really focusing on their local communities more, and liberal Protestants using their independent, separate, and unique sides more and really wanting the government more to protect their individual liberties rather than to leave their communities alone.
We're speaking with Dr. Hazel Rose Marcus. She's a professor of behavioral sciences at Stanford University. And Dr. Elena Connor. They're both cultural psychologists and co-authors of Clash, 8 Cultural Conflicts That Make Us Who We Are. It's Topical Currents. We're going to take a short break, and we'll be back and take some calls and some emails.
And 19 minutes past 1 o'clock. It is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, along with Bonnie Berman, and we resume our conversation with the co-authors of the book Clash, 8 Cultural Conflicts That Make Us Who We Are. If you'd like to join in the conversation, you're certainly welcome. 1-800-743-9576, 1-800-743-WLRN. And email, that's radio at WLRN.org, and Twitter.
Twitter is at Topical Currents. You can tell us about your experiences of cultural conflicts, how you've successfully or not successfully dealt with them.
Doctors, touch on modern gender culture. You say that women have gained more managerial and professional leads in education and entrepreneurship. So what's a guy got to do?
Well, what a guy has to do is actually pay attention to what's going on with gender. And we do find that women tend to use their interdependent selves more in the workplace than do men, who tend to use their independent selves. But in fact, although women are moving up the ladder, we find that what happens to them is they are pretty quickly crashing into that glass ceiling. And one of the clear examples of that is when you can see when women go to ask for a raise, what multiple studies show is that they're thinking not about themselves as an independent self, as unique, separate, and in control, but they're thinking about their interdependent side. They're thinking about their coworkers. They're thinking about their relationships in the office. Is it right for me as a woman to ask for more, to stand out, to get ahead? And what they do in bringing on their interdependent self is often not push for as much as they think they deserve or they do deserve, and they fall short of what they could get because of their interdependent self. So what we suggest for women is that they at those points try and think about their independent self and not giving away their interdependent self. For guys, what we suggest is that they become aware of their interdependent self and think what they could do in the office to foster more successful relationships, because in fact multiple studies show that people who use their interdependent selves, they form good, strong relationships, are empathic, caring about others, do very well in the workplace. It's a key to success.
You say that men and their independent, I suppose, macho tactics were the root of the big recession?
Well, and we're not alone. We are actually referring to several other commentators in that assertion. But certainly, this very independent, aggressive, risk-taking style resulted in people and organizations making decisions that imperiled everyone. And so one study was super interesting, looking at the investment decisions of men and women over, I think it was about 10 years, showed that men made much more risky investments and change their allocations in their retirement funds a lot more often. And this resulted in, over time, them losing money. So on average, women did a better job of investing their retirement portfolios than men did. And I think people extrapolate that research to organizational levels and looking at that sort of reckless risk-taking in the surface of trying to show how smart and unique and ahead of the pack a particular organization is. It's all fun and it's all well and good until you totally decimate your organization and fall to the back of the pack and take everyone down with you.
Which one of you is shuffling the papers? That's what we wanted. Our crew wants to know.
That may have been me. They fell down. I'm sorry.
Oh, okay.
But what if we said neither? I mean, this is called diffusion of responsibility. It's another interesting psychological tactic that you should cover on your show.
Well, let's get to that then. I'd like to turn to the white people versus people of color. You say that minorities care more about what other people think of them. Why is that, and what else did you find?
Well, we find that the race is one of the big sources of cultural clashes in the country, and you know it's on the headlines. It's part of daily news. It's critical. For example, I was just on a plane recently, and I was sitting there. I'm a European American. I'm sitting next to an African American man, and I noticed that he's really angrily flipping through the pages of a PowerPoint, looks like a diversity training course, and he turns to me, a white woman, and he says, "You know, he was a white man too. I don't know. I think I was going to tell this. So there's two white people. We're sitting next to each other on the plane, and he's looking through his folder, and he says to me, "Geez, why do we have to do this? Don't you know that race just doesn't matter anymore?" And he says, "I don't see race. Do you?" And I was a little bit stunned because I realized, well, I'm looking at a very independent self, someone who thinks he's individual, unique, in control, without culture, without history. But in study after study, we see that Blacks, Latinos, Asians have very interdependent selves, which means they think of themselves as connected, similar, and cooperating. And they tend to use these interdependent sides because other people so often treat them according to their race and ethnicity and not because of their individual qualities. And so when you're constantly confronted with the idea that your in-group, say in the case of African Americans, is inferior, and that message, the drumbeat of that message, is still loud and strong in this country, it's hard to be an independent self. You're very aware of yourself as interdependent. And then the rest of that story is, as we were talking, the third seat in our row was filled by an African American man, and I so much wanted to say, okay, let's talk about this. Let's have this conversation. Ask him if you think race matters. But I faltered at the last moment because I know that race is such a difficult conversation in this country. It makes us all so nervous.
So you're saying that white people don't think there's an issue so much anymore, where people of color think there's very much an issue.
Absolutely, and that's the source of the clash. But we now have hundreds of studies like, for example, resumes with white-sounding names like Emily Walsh or Greg Baker are 50% more likely to get a callback than identical resumes with black-sounding names like Lakeisha Washington or Jamal Jones. We know that judges give harsher penalties for blacks for the same crimes as whites. In medicine, we know that for patients with the same ages, symptoms, and insurance, doctors are more likely to recommend life-saving treatments like clot-busting drugs for whites than they are for blacks. Even in sports, a study of the NBA found that referees call fouls against black players more frequently than against white players. So you can see that African Americans are not dreaming this up. It's actually a fact that race matters every day in every way in their lives. And whites often living in very different worlds, in very different cultures, don't see this. They aren't aware of this. What they do see is, hey, we've got a black president. I mean, come on. Isn't race over now? Could it really
matter?
You talk
about the referees. The teams that play against LeBron James would probably disagree with that that notion.
Yeah.
It's always...
Or in the Michael Jordan era.
Yeah, yes. No, there's a lot of disagreement about it, and people will fight it endlessly about this in the bar. But several studies now have made this point in multiple sports. So it's just one example, and there's always, you know, variation, of course. But the point is that... Blacks are treated differently than whites, and what they are treated in ways in which they are seen through their, as a member of their group, through the lens of stereotypes rather than as individuals. And that's often what's so difficult for whites who think of themselves as independent and are treated as individuals, not seen through the lens of various stereotypes. They don't have that experience, and so it's really difficult to see why, like the passenger on the plane, why do we have to still care about race? And the fact is that we do, and what we try and do in the book is draw out these different worlds and the way race sets up different culture cycles for people, as well as to make some suggestions about how we can bridge these different cultures and reduce some conflicts, because it certainly is possible to reduce these conflicts.
So what would be, well, first I just want to invite our callers or emailers to join in the conversation. We're talking about Clash, 8 cultural conflicts that make us who we are, and we'd like to hear about your experiences with cultural conflicts one way or the other. 1-800-743-9576, 1-800-743-9576, or email radio@wlrn.org. radio@wlrn.org. So what are some suggestions for bridging these gaps and dealing with these clashes in terms race clash?
Well, in the book, for each of these clashes, we do give very specific advice based on abundant evidence. But just to start at a very high level, we have advice for any kind of cultural conflict you might find yourself in. So if you find yourself having a conflict with someone else, the first step is to realize, you know, maybe it's not about you as individuals. You know, maybe that person isn't an idiot or a jerk. Maybe you are stumbling over this independent, interdependent divide. And armed with that realization, we recommend that first you try interdependence. When we are being interdependent, we pay more attention to other people, which can give us better insights into the problem and its possible solutions. And that being interdependent requires listening, paying attention to the other person, understanding your place in a larger ecosystem and a larger hierarchy, and trying to think about the history between the groups that you're parts of. But if that doesn't work, try independence. Independence is great for people who have suffered oppression. It's great for if you need to think outside of the box and do something differently. It's great for innovation. And many people think that they have just one self, especially in the U.S. We're taught to be authentic and genuine, and that somehow that means just being the same person across all situations. But the fact of the matter is, none of us is the same person across all situations. And many of the different personae we assume, many of the different selves we use, do sort into independent or interdependent. So just understanding that you have these two different sides to yourself is often a 100% increase in understanding your personal resources and how to bring them to the table.
We have an emailer here who wants you to touch on cultural relativism, and does it justify acts that another culture may abhor?
Well, that's, of course, a very difficult problem, and it's one of the problems that we want to bring into the conversation. There are many cultures. There are multiple ways to be a person, to be a good person, to be a moral person. There may not be an infinite number, but there are certainly there's certainly more than one answer to what's good, true, beautiful, efficient in the world. And we need, first of all, to open up and understand these different cultural systems and how they operate before we start judging that this culture is bad, this culture is good, or lining them up in some sort of hierarchy. That may be possible to do. We certainly hold out the possibility that one could make a judgment about some cultures being bad. But at this point, we just don't know enough about human behavior and how cultures influence it and the different forms that culture can take, and we don't understand enough. I would say we have lots to do.
We have two women who are occasional guests who run a business on international business etiquette for those who have to travel so they don't go to Japan and, insult them unintentionally.
Yeah, I mean, it's so much of culture lives at this level of daily interactions and kind of everyday things we do. Like, how do you open a door? What happens next? If you're a European American, you walk through it. In Japan, you take your shoes off. And if you fail that one little step, you've just offended a whole room full of people. And so it's true that understanding all these, it's meaningless to us. It's just a foot covering, right? Like whether you have your shoes on or not.
Right.
But in Japanese culture, this is a really important symbolic transition from the outside to the inside. And being a civilized person is knowing that transition and performing this ritual of removing your shoes is also great for hygiene. I mean, the outside world tends to be very dirty, and the inside world tends to be, you'd like to keep it clean. So it's important to recognize that, you know, it might seem like a silly habit to us or a silly ritual, but to other people, that's the basis of being a good, moral, civilized person. And it goes both ways. Many of our customs are also strange. Like, why would you want to shake someone's hand? You don't know where the hand has been.
So bowing makes more sense. Or just take, there's so many, as Elena said, so many everyday examples. And you think, well, Isn't it the same? But no, these are different in different cultures. So take, for example, again, to continue with the Japanese, American contrast here, when people come, we think it's extremely polite and good to say to people, help yourself when they come into our houses. What would you want? Help yourself. We're allowing people to be their independent selves, to express their preferences, to choose what they want. In Japan, what's seen as the polite thing to do when a guest arrives is to have thought ahead of time what that guest would probably like, and to have that available and to serve that to the guest, the host's best guess or idea about what would be good for the guest is the way to handle things. So, I noticed last time we were together that you really enjoyed a turkey sandwich, so I made it for you again, which is in the service of an interdependent self,
right,
which has shown that you've paid attention to others and connected with them. But, just shoes and sandwiches, they're minor, but yet they are just saturated with cultural meanings that we have to understand, and it's exciting to be able to understand them.
Isn't it also a cultural thing in Japan where if a guest admires one of your possessions, that the Japanese will feel obligated to offer it, to give it to them?
That's right. No, people will often do that if it's something small in a home. I have collected, before I became aware of this, many, many bracelets and little prints and books that I have just casually made a comment about, as I would to try to, in an American colleague's home, to try to show that I was pleased with their tastes and I admired them. And then I find myself the recipient of these gifts because they want to share it and be empathic.
And that, what Hazel is describing is actually, she's actually illuminating a subtler point in her book, which is interdependence doesn't look the same across cultures. Hazel is an incredibly interdependent person. She's constantly thinking about other people and and making them feel good and saying nice things. But you can see in another culture, yes, complimenting someone and saying, I really like your pen will land you a new pen. And that's, you know, it's important to realize, although these are big categories of independence and interdependence, how cultures live them locally is quite different. It's not, these are not just big blanket categories that all those interdependent people look the same and all those independent people look the same.
And we find out here on the West Coast that interdependence really Asian approaches to interdependence can make problems on these sort of everyday levels, but it also can make problems more significant problems in schools and workplaces. For example,
talk about that crashing into the bamboo ceiling. Tell us about that.
Right. Well, we find that Asians, although they're only about 5% of the American population, fill many more places in the from 9 to 20%, depending on what part of the country, fill the top spots in universities, for example. And so there are many, many very well qualified Asians in the country, Asian Americans. But yet, if you look, you find that they're quite underrepresented in the executive suites of corporations and in government jobs and in high-level management positions. And in looking into that, it's what we find is that Asians tend to operate with their interdependent selves, in which they're concerned about emphasizing the ways in which they are similar, connected, and cooperative with others. But this doesn't often work for, it doesn't signal that you are ready to be a leader, that you're ready to be in charge of others. So that's the point at which Asians crash into the bamboo ceiling. And one of my graduate students in school here at Stanford, Hee Jung Kim, who's now a professor at the University of California, Santa Barbara, she was very irritated by this. She was from Seoul, South Korea, and she began in graduate school taking a seminar in which I required everybody to speak up in class, a small seminar. And so I was constantly calling on her, and she just wouldn't want to speak. She looked down. She wouldn't answer. I was so frustrated. One day at the end of class, she sent me an email. And in the signature of the email, she put the Korean proverb, the empty carriage rattles the loudest, meaning that the person who has the least to say is often the most talkative. And so then Hee Jung went on to conduct a brilliant set of studies showing that while it's true for European Americans that talking helps thinking, and that's certainly true of those who people believe this, and those who are deciding who should lead our corporations and lead our governments believe that. For Asians and Asian Americans, talking actually gets in the way of thinking clearly. And that's because for European Americans who tend to use their independent sides, talking is a very important tool for expressing the way that you're unique and separate and in control. But for Asians and Asian Americans who tend to use their interdependent sides, listening to others is a very important tool for figuring out how to relate and how to fit in with others. And in school, Confucian traditions, which are still practice in many Asian American homes, the best thing you could do when you're a student is clear your mind, put yourself in a receptive mode, and then take in the information. Then when you've taken in all the information, then and only then can you question and challenge and raise issues. But of course, for American students, I find in my seminars that they often have their hand in the air before I finish the question because they're ready to express their independent self.
Our telephone number, 1-800-743-9576. 1-800-743-WLRN. First caller, Shelley in Pembroke Pines. Hi.
Hi.
Speak up, Shelley.
I'm sorry. I was wondering what the panelists thought with respect to independence and interdependence about how the press and people in general have been reacting to the Trayvon Martin case and how they said they're going to riot if George Zimmerman is released.
Well, I think this is potentially a good illustration of what we were saying before. It's a clash between African Americans, people of color, who are understand Trayvon's situation, see Trayvon's situation. They see his life as one in which he was constantly aware of others and how their actions towards him, how he was treated because of the fact that he was a young black man. And they many people in his position think that they're never seen as independent individuals, but only through the lens of the stereotype of African American men, which is still a completely negative one. Whites, on the other hand, as I was saying before, don't see the way race impacts life because it doesn't impact life for them in that way. They are much more able to go about their life without being treated differently and in an inferior way because of their race. So quite reasonably, they assume, geez, why is this about race? Why is race an issue? But once again, it goes to people having very different experiences because of the cultural context in which they live.
And I'd add also that this, with the situation the caller is identifying about people being called to riot. In our book, we talk about everyone has this independent side and an interdependent side, but some people have both sides pretty well developed. And more so than many groups in the U.S., African Americans have a very well developed independent and interdependent side. So we talked about how the experience of discrimination and stereotyping and prejudice can lead people of color to have this very well developed interdependent side. African Americans have been trying to work against that for the past few centuries, and this has led to a very well developed independent side, and also just living side by side with European Americans in these very independent ways. And so, I think that call to riot, that call to protest, that call to fight a system that seems unjust is also indicative of this independent side, it often works. It often backfires when people take to the streets to protest. So,
can I ask you a follow up to that?
Quickly, yeah.
With respect to all that, as a person of color, how do you feel about the press representing this young man as a 12-year-old child when he's a 6'3" individual who beat up the guy pretty well? As a person of color, I look at that and I think, well, people tend to have much more wrath, if you will, more get up and go over children than they do grown people. And it would seem that that presentation has really inflamed the circumstance.
Well, certainly media are a huge factor in the culture cycle. We talk about media as one of the most potent features of the interaction level of culture. And media are not, no one is neutral. No one in the world, there's no such thing as a neutral human being. All of us have our many cultural backgrounds that we bring to work every day. You can't check them at the door. And so there's always going to be a misrepresentation, a quote-unquote misrepresentation, a quote-unquote bias. There's always an angle on a story. And so, yes, I think it's right to, when you consume media, to question, well, what is the story that people want me to believe? What side of this are they trying to tell me, and why are they trying to tell it to me?
Well, hopefully the media is also objective. We'd like to think. We're speaking with Dr. Hazel Rose Marcus, Professor of Behavioral Sciences at Stanford University, Dr. Elena Connor, and they're co-authors of Clash, 8 Cultural Conflicts That Make Us Who We Are. Another short break, and we'll be right back.
And we return 48 minutes past 1 o'clock. It is today's topical currents. Joseph Cooper, along with Bonnie Berman, we resume our conversation with Dr. Hazel Rose Marcus and Dr. Elena Connor. And their book is Clash, 8 Cultural Conflicts That Make Us Who We Are. We'll also have a link to the book at the WLRN.org website, as well as the Topical Currents Facebook page.
I found an interesting thing that people with more choices and social mobility care more about their appearance than those who don't, making them more superficial and looks conscious. So yes. Could you explain that a little bit? Because that kind of, and is that on the coasts in the Northeast? Where is that exactly? Definitely in the Southeast.
Yeah, this is also pretty awesome research by our colleague Vicky Plout and Glenn Adams and their team. And I think many of us who have grown up in rural areas or even like suburban areas who moved to a big major city feel this, that back where we grew up, your friends were the people you went to church with. Your friends were the people that you've been playing with my parents, you know, kissed each other on the playground when they were four. You know, it wasn't like a big casting call and a selection process. Mm-hmm. It was just, this is who I've been with forever. But then when you move to the big city, you all of a sudden have all these choices of people that you can affiliate with. There's just simply greater density there. And there's also greater mobility. People are moving in and out of these cities. And so all of a sudden, you know, you're not surrounded by people that you grew up with. You're not surrounded by people you went to church with. There's just this whole panoply of humanity. How are you going to choose your friends? And our colleagues find that attractiveness is a very important sorting mechanism in cities across the country. But then, of course, you have more cities on the coast than in the Midwest and the South. And so there is this confound of region, or this additional issue of region. And in the book, we tell a story of a friend of mine who is from Palatine, Illinois, moved to the San Francisco Bay Area, and realized that to succeed here, she was a 6'1" woman weighing 285 pounds, never been an issue in Illinois. And she realizes that to succeed professionally, she's going to have to lose weight. She lost 110 pounds. And I think a lot of people who move to the coast, who move to cities, which is often the same move, experience this, the need for to look good, because all of a sudden people are constructing their lives through individual choices based on their unique preferences and their desire to control their environments, as opposed to sort of making the best of what's going on around them. The former is a more independent tendency, and this desire to adjust and affiliate is a more interdependent tendency.
Let's take another quick call. Chris in Hollywood. Hi there.
Hi, how you guys doing?
Good.
Good. I just kind of in general, due to not the previous comment, which I really appreciated, but the comments about you know, black attitude versus white attitude or Hispanic attitude. Every person that I come across has to be taken on their own merits, and anytime I generalize, I'm generally wrong, and that's all I had to say.
Well, no, that's very good, and that's, I think, a feature of a good, well-elaborated interdependent self, because as we said, when you are leading with your interdependent self, what you do is listen. And in any interaction, in any situation, the most important thing to do is to start by listening, try to understand the other person, try to understand their situations. In our book, we say that one way to get a handle on people and their situations is to think about the cultural context that they've been part of, and for each of those cultural contexts to think about what interactions have they had, to think about the difference, for example, and we're talking to Trayvon Martin, the kinds of interactions he's been likely to have had compared to the ones that George Zimmerman has had, to think about the way institutions may have treated people differently in their two culture cycles, to think about different ideas and images that they may have been exposed to. So we couldn't agree with you more. Is to start by trying to listen, to understand the individual, and to use that to bridge divides.
We're getting close to the end of the program, so I wanted to bring this one up. You said that the have-nots struggle in the classrooms of the haves is widening the gap between rich and poor. Can we look at that one?
Oh, that's a huge ongoing cultural clash in the United States right now,
right,
between those who have a college education and those who don't. Only 25% of Americans have a college education, have completed four years of college. So mostly we are a working class nation still with more people who have not completed college. And what's happening is more and more first generation students, we call them students who come from homes where their parents have not gone to college, go into the classroom. What we find is a clash of interdependent selves, those are the selves that students from working class contexts bring with them, with the university. University is basically set up for independence. It's been arranged by independence. It encourages independence. To do well there, you must have a well-elaborated independent self. And what we're finding throughout the country is working class students, first generation students struggle. Even when they come in from good grades, from well prepared from high school, they get worse grades. They drop out more during their time in college. They don't make connections with other students or with professors. Mm-hmm. They often feel that they're treated poorly, that people are responding to them as if they're slow or passive. And it really what's at stake here is the need for institutions to recognize the interdependent selves that their students are bringing and to make some accommodations for this. It's not hard to do. Several recent intervention studies, some by our colleagues Mariam Hamadani and Nicole Stevens, show that if universities just take time to explain to students, first-generation students, that college operates according to this independent self, and you may encounter some difficulties here, but here's what you can do. For example, you can go to office hours and ask for help, something that first-generation students who are loath to do because it involves talking to the professor and they're not sure how they're going to do that, if they're capable of doing it. Tell them, yes, go. People want to help you. Ask for help for the TAs. If you get a grade that you don't like or an assignment you don't like, you can go and question it. You can express yourself. You can develop your own voice. In fact, you should. It's not difficult to do, but it has to be done.
Thank you so much, Dr. Hazel Rose Marcus and Dr. Elena Connor. They're both cultural psychologists and co-authors of Clash, 8 Cultural Conflicts That Make Us Who We Are. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
A pleasure.
And thanks for joining us. Our producer is Richard Ives, technical direction from Caroline Brader Watts. Paul Leary is online producer. We have free audio archives and downloads at our website, WLRN.org. More info as well on the Topical Currents Facebook page. Tomorrow's program begins with information about the latest technology in prostate cancer treatment. Also, Linda Gassenheimer's Food and Dining with our favorite wine columnist, Fred Tasker. To the calendar, a mixed bag. On this day in 1871, 142 years ago, the birth of French novelist Marcel Proust in Paris. He was one of the first European authors to openly deal with homosexuality. Also on this day, 1921, 92 years ago, the birth of middleweight boxing champ Jake LaMotta in the Bronx. Of course, he was played by Robert De Niro in the acclaimed Raging Bull film, and a sequel, The Bronx Bull, is due in October. Still living, Jake LaMotta fought Sugar Ray Robinson 6 times. One more while we recall Bugs Bunny, Daffy Duck, Porky Pig, Tweety Bird. On this day, 1989, the death of voice genius Mel Blanc, at age 82, in Los Angeles. He said his natural voice was most like Sylvester the Cat, but without the lispy spray. So we leave with a thought from Jake LaMotta, who was forced to take a dive in 1947 to get a shot at the middleweight title. Quote, "I fought sugar so many times, I should have diabetes." Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman. Stay tuned now for Here and Now from NPR News.